south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
Today, how about we talk about a revolting subject, lawyers. Yep, you probably figured out lawyers are corrupt everywhere. But could it be they're all corrupt? Are they all crooked? Can we make a general statement like that? Well, I have to admit, previous to the COVIDiot crap about 2020, a case could have been made that a certain percentage of lawyers are good guys, or were good guys, who follow the letter of the law. But is that really good, to follow the letter of the law, when we've seen lately so many laws just suck? But, you know, especially recently with the Trump indictments, what are there, something like 60 now? It's just impossible to believe that, in the States anyway, lawyers in the legal system are on the level. Of course, lawyers are corrupt in Latin America too, but just how corrupt are they? And what's the difference between Latin American lawyers and American lawyers? And how much does all that affect gringos and expats? Maybe you're thinking, why jump from the frying pan into the fire? Maybe I should just forget about this Plan B thing altogether. Throw in the towel, stay in Cleveland, and forget about getting the hell out of Dodge. Have those thoughts crossed your mind? Thinking you'll stick it out. Stay put in Cleveland, suffer through the bad things that are coming as the shit hits the fan worldwide? Now, if you're listening to this program, you already know bad shit's coming. And I know some, if not most of you gonna-bes and wannabes are thinking, it just seems like it's way too much work to get the hell out of Dodge. Too much crap to organize. And as the world keeps imploding, you're thinking you can run, but you can't hide. So why bother? It may be interesting to contemplate, but in practice, a no-go. Well, let me try to dissuade you of that notion. Give you 10 more good reasons why you really have to shit or get off the pot. Starting with a few facts about lawyers. Starting with U.S. lawyers. Now, you probably never heard of this lawyer unless you're a lawyer yourself. His name is Patrick L. Schultz. Former big firm attorney and associate professor of law at Indiana's Notre Dame Law School, and he's a present-day judge. Turns out, in a recent address to incoming law students of Notre Dame, in his speech, he got completely honest. Unusual for a lawyer, right? He said lots of things, true things he got blowback for. For example, speaking to that class of fresh, green, new lawyers, he says, quote, "If when you graduate, you go to work for a big law firm, you will probably begin to practice law unethically in at least some respects within your first year or two. This happens to most young lawyers," he says, "in big firms." "I know," he said, "it happened to me." Now remember, this guy's a Notre Dame professor and a judge. He said, "It's all a big game and money is how you keep score in that game." He says, "When you start working as a lawyer, you begin to get a fever that's exacerbated by regular trade press articles telling how much money this or that big shot lawyer is making annually. You're always comparing yourself to the income of the other guy." He says, "When lists of lawyers' incomes are published biannually, they're pored over by every other up-and-coming lawyer with the intensity of a small boy poring over the statistics of his favorite baseball player. It's an obsession." That, he says, is how youthful idealism in young lawyers quickly gets stale and grows moldy. He says, "Fresh, new, young, idealistic lawyers walk out of school and arrive at their first job, a big firm, to discover a new set of rules and symbols. Instead of competing for grades, they must compete for wealth. That's the new symbol of status on the outside." He says, "The culture of lawyers will pressure you in many subtle ways to replace your old school values with the system's new monetary values." He says, "Note that during your first month working for a new law firm, a senior partner will invite you to a barbecue. You'll feel honored, and man, will you be impressed. You'll travel up a long drive, park your used Honda, buy ranks of luxury cars, walk up to a long drive towards an enormous house. Some butler in a suit and a black bow tie will answer the door. You'll be led to a huge garden. They'll serve you pate and shrimp and miniature quiches and cocktails. there'll be grilled swordfish and caviar, and in the corner, you'll glimpse the senior partners sipping on glasses of wine, holding court with a group of junior partners and senior associates. You'll notice the most senior partner will be wearing designer sunglasses, designer clothes, logos on his shirt. His clothes will be impeccable. Even his shorts will be pressed. He'll have a beautiful tan and the nicest haircut you've ever seen. He explained to the new class of lawyers in this and in a thousand other subtle ways. You'll begin to absorb how lawyers really play the game. He said to the young class of lawyers, it's very difficult for any young lawyer immersed in this culture, day after day, to maintain any of the values you had as a law student. Slowly, almost imperceptibly, your young lawyer attitude will change. You'll begin to admire things you did not admire before, be secretly ashamed of things you never contemplated before, and find it impossible to live without certain creature comforts and status markers you never had or needed before. Somewhere, somehow, he says, a young lawyer changes from a person who gets intense pleasure from being able to buy an expensive iPhone to a person enraged over a $400,000 bonus when the other junior partners got five. The stage is set early, he says, and in order to win, the young lawyer will begin to cheat in ways that seem at first excusable. He'll bill a client for 90 minutes for a job that took an hour, in his mind promising himself to repay that half hour another time, thinking it's not stealing, it's borrowing. And they'll do it for a while. They'll repay. But then they'll stop repaying as time goes on. Soon they'll convince themselves they did such a good job for the client that the extra padding of the bill was justified. Why shouldn't he pay a little bit more for it? I'm worth it. Along with that, the new lawyer will soon start lying to get an edge, too. Whether it's fake excuses over missed deadlines or conveniently misplacing a document that's unhelpful to a case, he says you slowly slip into that mindset, and after a couple of years, you won't notice you're continuously lying, cheating, and stealing. He says you'll be making dozens of quick, instinctive decisions every day, but those decisions, instead of reflecting on the notions of right and wrong, by which you might even conduct your own personal life, at work, instead, you'll reflect a different set of values, a set of values that embodies not what is right and wrong, but what's profitable and what you can get away with. That, the law professor says, is what the legal profession adds up to these days, which begs the question, why would you ever want your kid to be a lawyer? All right, meet Johnny here. What do you think of that? Have you got any lawyers in your family? Well, you know, like my mother used to say, as far as kids going into a profession, she said every family needs a physician, a dentist, an accountant, a plumber, a cop, and a lawyer. Oh, and if your mom's Catholic, a priest. For a mom or any family, that's covering all the bases. Yeah, that's right. Even though almost everyone in the U.S. knows being a lawyer is a pretty unholy profession. Still, every extended family ought to have one, since the average person in the U.S., even a slug, gets sued, according to stats, 8 times in his life. Meanwhile, statistics show the average Latin American gets sued about once his entire life. Now, down here in Latin America, every mother would love one of her kids to be a lawyer as well. Though you just have to remember, any college graduate in the family is a huge badge of honor. Funny thing, too, about lawyers here in Latin America. Even though everyone knows they're crooked, or at least everyone has a price, they don't suffer that horrible reputational stink that stateside lawyers do. Probably because there are so few lawsuits, that means exponentially less pissed off clients. Personally, I found the big difference between lawyers in the States and lawyers down here is that your Latin American lawyer will often become a very good friend, in some cases your best friend, something that rarely happens in the States. Nevertheless, it's absolutely true, and of course it's part of your gringo advantage, and the fact that Latino lawyers absolutely prefer gringo clients for obvious reasons. Number one being, we rarely speak Spanish, and even if we do, we can't write in Spanish worth a shit, so they have to translate every legal document into Spanish, and vice versa. That means, automatically, your lawyer is going to get extra work out of you. Number two, we pay up front. Our word can be counted on. We show up at the appointed times, even though they may not. We refer other gringos, etc., etc. But here's the thing. When's the last time you had to sit down with your lawyer up in the States, or called the office even to talk to the secretary? When's the last time you did that and did not get charged for the time? Nope, in Milwaukee, Cleveland, New York, Chicago, Every second you're sitting with your lawyer or on the phone with his assistant, you're on the clock for a couple $100 an hour, too. Whereas down here in Latin America, that almost never happens. You never get charged for phone calls. In fact, if you pop in and talk to your lawyer, have a coffee with them, sit around for a half hour or so, you're never going to get charged. They love to shoot the breeze with gringos, practice their English and all that. Down here, almost 100% of the time, the clock's not running. They charge you for the service they perform, not for the hours, minutes, or seconds they spend doing it. And it's a good thing, too. And personally, I believe they haven't switched over to the gringo way of billing yet is because of that old devil mañana time. Man, I'm telling you, if Latino lawyers had the clock running during mañana time, the average gringo would be bankrupt the first trip down. Anyway, here's how they bill you. For example, you want to get your residency started or a will drawn up, title search done on a piece of property you're looking at, your lawyer will give you a price right up front. Now, the other thing that might come as a shock to you is that when you're sitting in your lawyer's office, he just might say, "What you doing this Sunday? I'm having a barbecue over at the house. Come on over. You're invited." And more than likely, after two or three sit-downs with him for whatever reason, you'll get invited to his daughter's quinceañeros party, to breakfast, lunches, dinners, sporting events, the beach house, the club. Because you're a gringo, you're in. Now, whether you go along with all that is up to you and your personality and how you feel about hanging with the guy in general. Just note, if you're not too much of a dickhead yourself, he probably will provide those friendly gestures. Just think of how different that is with lawyers you've had experience with up in the States. When's the last time your stateside lawyer wanted to buddy up with you? Unless he was a relative or a college friend, probably never. Now, about the corrupt part. I'll tell you, everybody wants to know about the corrupt part. Well, you longtime listeners have heard me say many times, depending how connected your Latino lawyer is, he can bend and twist the rules in ways a first world lawyer could never imagine. Oh, and if you ever run into a situation or a problem and your lawyer hits a brick wall, again, depending on his connections, if he hits a wall or a dead end, you might hear those famous last words. "Well, you see, I can't get involved with that, but I do know a guy who knows a guy." And for lots of gringos and expats who have their own particular problems, that's music to their ears. Hey, while we're at it, how about a Latin American lawyer story? After all, this might happen to you. Probably not, though. Anyway, not so long ago, well, within my living memory anyway, one of my Latin lawyers, you know, every Latin American country I've lived in, I've had a lawyer or two. You really can't use the same one for different countries because they're licensed in a particular country, just like in the States, a lawyer's licensed in a particular state. You know what it's like. You have to take a specific exam in each state to get licensed. So lawyers and doctors and such, they're usually licensed in a state or country and can't practice outside of it. Anyway, one particular day I was with my Latino lawyer, who shall remain nameless. We made a stop at his cousin's body repair shop. We stepped out of the car, walked on over to a late model Audi that was completely smashed up. It turns out it had just arrived in the United States, a wrecked car bought at auction for around $10,000. Now, an unwrecked Audi SUV of that make and model would probably have been around $35,000. Well, fast forward to about a month later, I visited my lawyer's house, and lo and behold, a beautiful Audi SUV was sitting in the driveway. Yep, that same wrecked car, completely repaired now, just like new. And I said to my lawyer friend, "Wow, so you bought the car that was in the shop the other day, huh? Nice job, I would have never known that thing was wrecked." I said, "You did buy it, right? If you didn't, what's it doing here?" He said, "That was my car all along. I bought it online at a Texas auction, had it shipped down, and my cousin fixed it." I said, "Wow, well, you should be able to get good money for it now. It's perfect. I don't know mechanically, but cosmetically, it looks great." I said, "Now, there's a good business plan. Sounds like a great moneymaker. Buy an expensive late model wreck, bring it down, have it fixed up, and get two or three times what you paid for it." He said, "Oh, no, I'm not selling it. I'm keeping it for myself." Now, this lawyer had two other cars, a pickup and a RAV4. Both of them in pretty good condition, but 10 or 12 years old. Well, long story short, he wanted to keep all three. I don't know why, but I soon found out. Anyway, after that, I'd see him around town, always driving the pickup or the RAV4. But every time I went to his nice office in a great neighborhood, I'd see that big Audi SUV in his parking spot. And when I'd see him at an event or a resort or a brunch, he'd be driving that car too. And finally, one day I said to him, "You know, I hardly ever see you in that Audi. You're always in the RAV4 or the pickup truck. And he said to me, very seriously, he says, that thing's a big gas hog. I only use it to drive to the office and when I know I'm going to have a meeting with a client or I'm going to run into prospective clients. I said, really, why? He says, I'm a lawyer. I have to have a car like that, he said. He said, it helps me maintain and cultivate a certain class of client. And I thought, if that's his marketing technique, you can't fault him for that. But I couldn't believe he was that honest about it. Then he said, you have to look successful to be successful. I thought, man, he must have got a copy of How to Win Friends and Influence People. You know, Dale Carnegie's book? Yep, they've got that old ancient fossil of a self-help book down here too, translated into Spanish. I've seen it in bookstores and in book racks at supermarkets. I never thought anyone read it, but anyway, what he was telling me is he had to look the part to cultivate a certain class of clients. Now, as for me, I wasn't buying it. And I tried to school him. I said, look, I see your point, but there are certain unintended consequences. In fact, it could work against you. I said, as for me, and maybe I'm not your typical expat gringo, but I don't really want to see my lawyers or doctors driving around in a big expensive car that I'd never drive. Because it does go through your mind that his fees are probably a lot higher than normal, too. And as for me, that really is the way I think and the way many expats and gringos think, too. We don't much like it when we see Latino professionals we deal with getting way too caught up in the gringo materialistic world that most of us have been trying to escape from. I mean, look, if you're going to have a plan B, get the hell out of Dodge and all that, you should be downsizing a lot. In fact, I remember making the rounds to visit various plastic surgeons in Guatemala. I was taking two expat gringo ladies around, getting estimates on some nips and tucks. Now, that's not too unusual, really. Some of the seminar folks, you know, stay on an extra couple of days to check out things like that. Anyway, I remember pulling into the parking lot of one particular cosmetic surgery clinic, and I noticed there was a shiny new red Corvette in the doctor's parking space with vanity plates that said, Dr. Vargas. And I thought to myself, bad first impression. Already I'm not liking this guy. I'm thinking, number one, he's a big show-off. Number two, he blows his money stupidly because a Corvette's one of the worst cars to drive here in Latin America. What, with all the speed bumps, holes, and road obstacles, a car like that so low to the road, in no time the undercarriage gets completely ruined. Not to mention those constant rainy season intersection floods. They can almost come up to the floorboards, even on an SUV. By the way, vanity plates down here in Latin America are so rare that when you see them, you do a double take. Yep, you do see them sometimes. And when you do, what they're really screaming out is extreme gringo wannabe on board. Look, if you were a gringo or an expat living down here, you'd think that way too, because the number one rule for us gringos and expats is to have a low profile. And you'd think any and most professionals, especially doctors, would have at least a half a brain, a better than average IQ. So then why do so many of them still engage in what you might call adolescent pissing contests? Seems there's always that kind of competition between doctors and their cars in hospital parking lots. Anyway, I tried to use that kind of reasoning on the lawyer with that big Audi SUV. It fell on deaf ears. He insisted it was necessary to look the part of a successful, almost gringo-like lawyer. Exactly what us gringos and expats don't want, a gringo-wise lawyer. Oh well. That's one of the downsides and unintended consequences of the gringo advantage. Practically every Latino professional wants to be like his gringo counterpart. Pretty funny, actually. If they only knew the truth that our legal and healthcare systems are absolutely falling apart. If they only knew how badly we them up. And you'd think the smarter Latinos with higher IQs would start to get it. I mean, you'd think they'd ask the simple question. Why are so many smart, wealthy gringos moving down? Why do more and more of us keep coming? But somehow that question never seems to enter the average Latin American mind. In fact, dozens of times I've been in conversations with bright Latinos. They rarely ask me why I'm down here. And when I nicely explain how the United States is cracking around the edges and falling apart, that the American dream, the sueño americano, is gone, it's kaput, by then they've lost interest and are talking to someone else. Enough said about that. Have you seen the news fresh out of Mexico from April 25th? I'm reading this from an article out of Ecuador's largest rag. The headline? The head of Mexico's Secret Service acknowledged Tuesday that the country is the champion of the world's fentanyl production. And I'll paraphrase this. It says, the statement appears to run completely counter to past statements by President Andres Lopez Obrador, who has hotly denied in the past that any fentanyl that passes through Mexico was not produced there. It came through China and it was only pressed into pills when it ended up in Mexico. Meanwhile, Felipe De Jesus Gallo, head of Mexican's Criminal Investigation Agency and Secret Service, says that since the 1990s, Mexico has not only been number one in methamphetamine world production, but now fentanyl too. By the way, he was speaking on the record at a U.S.-Mexico conference on synthetic drugs in Mexico City on April 25th. Anyway, in case you had any doubts as to the origin of the drug that causes about 70,000 deaths in the U.S. annually. That's more than all the deaths of U.S. soldiers in Vietnam, by the way. Now, the head of the agency also says, quote, believe me, methamphetamine and fentanyl production have become industrialized in Mexico. It's not just in the mountains anymore, he said. We're seeing hundreds, if not thousands, of laboratories everywhere. He says the meth and fentanyl trade is so lucrative and so sophisticated that Mexican meth and fentanyl is exported as far away as Hong Kong, Europe, and Australia. But you knew that already, right? In fact, he goes on to say, just last year, soldiers seized more than 500,000 fentanyl pills in just one drug lab. Meanwhile, and you can look this up, President Lopez Obrador, who took office on December 1st, 2018, has claimed many times in many official speeches that Mexicans are culturally immune themselves to drug addiction. Man, that idiot's got about a 3-watt light bulb in his head. Meanwhile, it's time to talk about water again. You know, I talk enough about water, purifiers, nano and microplastics floating in the stuff. And of course, one of the things I keep hammering on over and over again is that once you move down to Latin America, get that plan B going, try to get a place that's not on municipal water. Because it's being reported now that practically all municipal water supplies throughout Latin America, that's city water, the taps are being rationed. They're not flowing 24/7. Now, of course, you've heard me talk about this before, that if you're on city water and you have a cistern on your roof, you're probably okay and you never even noticed that the city water's been cut off a couple hours a day, every day. You won't notice that if you've got a cistern because the cistern's collecting water at night when, of course, businesses are closed and everyone's asleep and no one's using the water supply. So the water supply at the city source builds up pressure again. So by early morning, your cistern is filled up again and it's got an auxiliary pump and a water pressure sensor. And during the day when it detects there's no water pressure, water from the cistern automatically switches in and you don't even notice it. And that's why it's understandable when occasionally I get an email from a gringo saying, hey, Johnny, I've been living in Latin America for a year now, and you're wrong. My city water, my municipal water, never goes out. Well, congratulations, bud. But just look on your roof. If you've got a cistern, your city water drops out a couple hours a day, whether you know it or not. The fact is, there'd be no reason to bear the expense of a cistern unless you did have an inconsistent water pressure problem. Of course, you've also heard me say that there really is no water problem in Latin America. It's a lard-ass government maintenance problem once again, since it's been reported countless times that around half of the water in municipal water systems is lost due to bad pipes, deterioration, leaks, etc. So instead of the government doing the maintenance, the people suffer. And if you thought all the bad news about water shortages is just coming out of Mexico City, well, you're wrong. Just this week, it's reported that Bogota, Colombia's capital city, started a severe water rationing program as of last Thursday. I'm getting this from a Colombian newspaper now. It says Bogota and dozens of surrounding towns have been divided into 9 different zones, with municipal water being cut off for 24 hours at a time in each zone on a rotational basis. They'll be rotating the planned outages every 10 days. The measure, it says, will affect 9 million people. So here's how it goes. If you live in Bogota, every 9 days, you'll have no water for 24 hours. They've also stated that most cisterns will not be able to keep up with that, leaving, it says, residents to believe they will have to start cozying up to friends across town to access drinking water when their 24-hour shutoff period comes. By the way, it says here, the mayor has called for a behavioral change in the population to help sustain and guarantee there's water enough for everyone. Saying, get this, and he's serious, it's time to double up with friends and relatives while you shower. By the way, there's a comment section here, and one guy writes, I live in Bogota. The real problem here is the bad and aging infrastructure and lack of maintenance and development. Like, that's new news. He says, years of neglect and corruption plague Bogota's infrastructure systems. Another guy writes in and says, I sat on two different water and sewer district boards in Colombia, and one of them had so little money for maintenance, there was an estimated loss of 2 million gallons of water a month just from underground leaky pipes. And it's even worse in Mexico. Check this out. Title of the article, and it just came out yesterday, Angry Farmers in Once Lush Mexican States Target Avocado Farms That Suck Up Way Too Much Water. It says, as one of Mexico's worst droughts drags on, angry farmers have been taking direct action against avocado orchards and berry fields on commercial farms that are drying up the streams in the mountains around Mexico City. It says the extensive use of water for the country's export crops led by avocados are drying up all the water sources for consumer use. So, in recent days, farmers and activists have been organizing teams to go into the mountains and rip out water pumps that tap into private irrigation holding ponds. Around Mexico City in the last 10 years, organizers say, the streams, the springs, and the rivers have been drying up, mostly because the water has been captured mainly for use by avocados and berry farms. They estimate that there are around 850 private plastic-lined ponds constantly filled by tapping rivers in and around the area. Now, of course, the drug cartels have gotten into the act because they make money from illegal logging and extort money from avocado growers. So as a result, when the activists cut water supplies, they suffer threats, get kidnapped, and beat, even killed by cartel members. Activists say they're running a serious risk. But if they don't get access to that water, they and their farm animals will die too. If you were to see it for yourself, you'd see the lake and stream situations are so bad due to drought, deforestation, sediment buildup, and heavy demands from avocado and berry growers. It's been estimated that 90% of the boats that used to fish and ferry tourists around the nearby lakes are now out of service. For example, nearby Lake Cuitzeo, one of the largest freshwater lakes in Mexico, is now nearly dry, with Mexico City on water rationing too. There are 100 different tanker trucks taking water from nearby lakes, running back and forth to the city, filling people's cisterns for a price. All right, there's more to this article, but you get the point. Knowing all that, it begs the question, for all you people living in Mexico, how's that Plan C coming?
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.